Last week we had been talking about this marriage feast at Cana of Galilee. We went into several introductory matters about it as to the significance, for example, of the use of wine, the symbolic meaning of that wine, and to make a transitional statement, the important thing about the wine usage is that it was throughout the Old Testament a symbol of joy or of blessing from the Lord. Now, when Jesus was at this marriage feast, the wine had run out. And we cannot help but be almost pressed into the realization that there is a symbolic meaning to that. In fact, in Jesus' response to this matter, he asks them to fill up the water pots, which were there for the purifying of the Jews, and we will come to that, but I just want to indicate that he identifies this whole matter in such a way that we are impelled to feel that he is saying that the wine of God's blessing had run out as far as Israel was concerned. And what had been a rather glorious religion was replaced by an empty shell. Judaism was an empty shell as far as the former Jewish religion was concerned. The early establishment of the Jewish religion was in glorious terms. Moses coming down from the mount was so filled with the Spirit of God as the law was conveyed to him that his face shone. And he had to put a veil over his face because it was so bright. So the Jewish religion was established in glory, but had fallen to bitter depths by the time Christ came. And so the religious leaders of the day, the Pharisees, were, in Jesus' words, rank hypocrites. There was nothing glorious about the religion of the Jews at that time. And so it is rather compelling here to feel that the wine running out at this feast was symbolic of the essence of the Jewish religion and the value of it running out. Now, we'll go on and pick up the details of this, which are themselves very very revealing about Christ. In fact, I want you to continually keep in mind that our emphasis here, as we look through the Gospel of John, is not just to find more religious ideas, but to get a picture of who Jesus Christ is, and to try as nearly as possible to get a sound and truthful picture of it. You know, there are in the church today so many different attitudes as to what Jesus Christ is like. You know, you've got so many different ideas that sometimes I fear we're in danger of a form of idolatry, where we fashion our own image of what Jesus ought to be and then worship that image. Some of the absurdities that come out in terms of who Christ is have driven many people even away from the gospel. And Jesus becomes a figure of contempt. In the early days where Jesus was on the earth, he was never seen as a silly figure that people today often see him. He was a dynamic force, and people either loved him or hated him. He says, the world hates me. They weren't just making fun of him or something like that. But today, the silly image that some people present, I mean, the picture they present of Jesus, opens him to contempt. The things they claim for him, and so forth. So, we like to reveal here, we like to open up our minds to who Jesus really is, as nearly as we can tell that, and as nearly as the Holy Spirit can convey to us the message, which indeed we do always pray that he will. Now, here is this figure, Jesus. He's at the feast. We conveyed to you last week that you have to see Jesus as a rather normal person on the earth. We pointed out that he attended the various social events enough that he himself admitted that people called him a wine bibber and a glutton. Well, they did it viciously and untruthfully, of course, but they, at least he was there enough that that challenge had some weight to it, as far as other people were concerned. He was then to be looked upon as a rather normal person living out his life among the people. They did not always like him, and as I say, so many of them hated him because of his message, but still he walked among them in some degree of normalcy, quite a little normalcy. Now, he's at the feast, and the wine has run out, and his mother tells him about it. She says, look, they run out of wine, and she's expecting him to say to her, oh, fine, I'll take care of that for you, and snap his fingers, you see, and here comes the wine. But he isn't buying that kind of a thing. I presume that already in his own mind he felt that he might do something about it, but he said to his mother, what is that to me and to you? Now, the King James has it, and maybe some other translation, what have I to do with you, woman? Which sounds like a rather disrespectful response. Does not seem worthy of Jesus that he would talk to his mother that way. But that's not quite the way he said it. He said, what is that to you and to me? Now, the word woman is not given as a title of disrespect, but almost in the same way that one might say ma'am, you see, it was a title of respect to her. And he goes on to say, to explain his statement, my hour has not yet come. And he is saying to her, I was not given this power to go around and do magic tricks. There's a penetrating point I'd like to get across on this matter, and this is relevant. This is a point where we can do that. It is always a question in my mind as to why people want power. In many religious groups, people are seeking for power of some kind, unusual power. They want to speak in tongues, or they want to be able to heal somebody, or they want to get healing for themselves, and they're always out looking for the power, you see. And they want the Lord to do something with them, to give them a great ecstatic experience, all the rest of these things. And I constantly ask them, what are you going to do with it? With that power? Just want to feel good? The Lord gave anointing for ministry. He anointed the disciples, and they needed the power to go out and move the world for his sake. But the average Christian would not be able to handle the power if he gave it to them. I have probably mentioned here before, but let's reiterate for an important purpose here. And you can think about it as a very practical application. Here is a whole process of electricity. Electricity that comes into our home. I've probably mentioned it before, but let's look at it again. The current as it comes off of the generator from the water source, turbines and then the generators, is way beyond the voltage that you could possibly use in a home. You're in thousands of volts as it comes off the generator. Now, you have a series of transformers. What is a transformer? It transforms the voltage from one to another, one current to another. So the power has to be stepped down from the thousands of volts, clear down to finally 220 or 110 as it comes into your home. maybe 440 in a factory, or sometimes 880 or something like that, but it comes into your home from thousands of volts down to 220 or 110. And even if you put 220 through it, you're ruining it. You ruin everything. You put a toaster on a 220 line and wham, it's blown. I was over in Europe. I had some electric equipment. I think it was a hair dryer or something like that over there. So my wife had that one and she plugged that in a wall and it blew it up because the current coming in and there is 220. So just in 1 minute it was gone. All it was to it. Now, the power has to be stepped down so you can use it in your home. Now here are people going to meetings. Oh Lord, give us the power. You know, all this, for what? What are they going to do with it? Just going to feel happy? Jump up and down, do magic tricks, show everybody how great they are? Run around indiscriminately trying to bail people out of trouble that maybe the Lord wants them to hang into for a while.
I suppose probably since he didn't say that he was somebody
where
else
than
doing the
fasting. Well,
I mean,
this is not. But this is not normally. See, if this were the thing they were really seeking, they would be satisfied just to say, Lord, help me to do your work or something. Instead of demanding with it some great charge, some great feeling, some great hilarity within them. You see. Well, you see, it's a desire of the flesh to become elated, that's all. It has nothing to do with spirituality. Now, we must let the Spirit of God give his gifts as he will. And it may be strictly personal or selfish interest that demands something from God that we can consume on ourselves. The thing we must seek, and this is a really critical point, the thing we must seek is Christ, not his gift. When Christ is in us, he will dispense to us what he wants us to have. If he has a task for you to do, he's going to give you the power to do it. But we can be like a bunch of gold diggers, coming for the power, coming for the gifts, coming for the feelings of elation and so forth. Now I will say this. Usually people will stop at the point that they find satisfying their desire. Thus, if a person is looking for elation, happy feelings, this sort of thing, and they go to a place where they are able to get this, they'll stop at that point. If they're seeking for Christ, they may not be satisfied with that. See, and they'll go on. This is how you keep from getting off the track. People who are seeking for, to go on a lower level, people who are just seeking for a social outlet, they will go someplace where they get the social outlet, and when they get that, they're satisfied. They stop there. They may never meet Christ. You could go to a lot of churches where you never meet Christ at all. But if you find a social group, if you like, you're satisfied, you stop. There are people who want a nice religious feeling. They go to some church where they get the religious sense, they got the things that create that, there's nothing against the things that we are going to mention, but they've got the stained glass windows and they pipe organ and the choir and so forth. And remember, I'm not saying anything wrong with any of those, but if a person is seeking just for a religious feeling or inspiration, in quotes, they might stop there. They may never hear about Christ. But the choir is singing Handel. The organist may take them through Bach. And this is lovely, beautiful. I enjoy that myself. Nothing wrong with it, except that if that's all one is seeking, and they find a place where they get that, they may stop there. Here's a person who's seeking knowledge. They want to be an expert on the Bible. Now let me say to you, the reason for studying the Bible is not to become an expert on the Bible, it's to find Christ and to know how to live with it. And there again, we may make many mistakes in our approach to this by trying to interest people in the fascinating study of the charts and graphs and outlines and so forth of the Bible. There's a reason to study the Bible. The main reason is to find out who Christ is so that we can live with Him. So that would be the way some people approach to study the Bible is the way some people might approach, say, a marriage seminar or an institute on marriage, where they get their kicks out of talking about marriage but never apply any of it to their life. You can go through a whole seminary course on the Bible and become very knowledgeable about it and never know Christ at all. Many seminarians don't know Christ. The churches are full of liberal pastors that have gone all the way through seminary, graduate school, and become very expert in philosophy and psychology and theology and don't know Christ at all. So if a person's main objective is to find knowledge, and they go to some place where they're just getting this knowledge, once again, they may not know Christ at all, but they're satisfied that they're getting knowledge. Now, for example, a certain religious group, and I'll just mention, like, say, the Jehovah's Witnesses. I'm going to mention a name here. If some of you belong to that, it's unfortunate. But one of the great problems with the Jehovah's Witnesses, one of the problems is that they're so constantly focused on knowledge about religion, the Bible, the future, prophecy, all these things, that they never get involved with Jesus Christ. I happen to know some very well, some of these people. In fact, I thought Sunday with a young man who'd spent quite a few months living with Jehovah's Witness friends and got the whole thing and spent some time going to the meetings and so forth, and this was one of his things, one of the reasons why, fortunately, he came out of it, and I'd given him some books much earlier that he then decided maybe he ought to read, but it was something, things that focused on Christ. These books that I recommended to him were directing his mind toward Christ, but when he saw the contrast, he realized that all they had was religion. But as far as Christ in the Spirit, they didn't have it. I mean, it wasn't at least something that was important to them. You talk to any number of Jehovah's Witnesses, you will not find they're very much concerned about the life of Christ within them. They're concerned about figuring out the Trinity, or they don't believe in the Trinity, but figuring out the meaning of God and the prophecies and the 144,000. They got all of that. Any pagan can study a book, can study the Bible, and just get all the knowledge from it. There's a lot of people that read the Bible and compare it with some other books. So, for example, Mahatma Gandhi was an avid reader of the Bible, but he read it along with the Bhagavad Gita and the Vedas and so forth. And his search, Gandhi's search, I know something about his life, was not to find Christ. His search was to find a world of peace. He came to promote the idea of ahimsa, nonviolence. And he wanted love among one another. But he was not seeking for Christ. So, at this point, you see, this is the reason it's important is because this miracle at Cana of Galilee was the first miracle that Jesus did. But he himself set the bounds of and the meaning of the miracles. There was a timing to it. There was a manifesting of his glory involved in it. It had nothing to do with making everybody happier. It had nothing to do with selfish interests. All some people can think about is keeping healthy, getting healed, being happy. You hear lots of testimonies in this direction, you know, that business was bad and they came to the Lord and their business came began to prosper and all this sort of thing. And that's nice, and I don't say the Lord wouldn't prosper a person's business, but I'm saying, well, let's keep our focus. He might take your business away.
Yes. What about a statement that the Lord wants us to be happy and healthy and emotionally sound individuals?
Well, that's not a biblical statement. There are a lot of statements people make. Nothing in the Bible about that. The whole book of Job might teach you that. You cannot move in that vein. Paul was not a healthy, happy individual. In those respects, he was a sick, beaten man, but the Spirit of God used him to turn a continent practically to Christ. And he said one of the reasons he wasn't a very prosperous individual was because he might be too proud. He said, this is 2 Corinthians 12:9. He said, I had a thorn in the flesh, a messenger of Satan that buffeted me lest I be over exalted. And many of the Lord's servants, many that I know, and many that I know very personally, have been great men of God, have been men whose private life was constantly harassed and troubled, and they were constantly fighting illness and things of this type. Yet great ministry was done for Christ. And it's just one of those things that the Old Testament standard was that God prospered his people as they obeyed him, and they prospered them materially. But it was a whole new ballgame. In the New Testament, he says, blessed are the poor.
What about the several different where it says happy as a man, what does that happy mean?
Very important point. And if you don't know anything about the possibility of the Greek language, you will read it, blessed is the man. And if you think you know something about the Greek language, you'll say, happy is the man, and you'll be closer to it if you don't know anything about the Greek language, because blessed is the best translation. Happy conveys an extremely superficial knowledge of Greek. Makarios, which is a word, can be translated happy, but not in the modern English sense of happy. If you look in a lexicon and see the word happy as the translation of Makarios, you have to understand it as in its linguistic roots or semantic roots in the word hap, which means fortune. And the best equivalent of that word is touched by God is the poor in spirit. Touched by God is the persecuted, you see. That's the best translation of that word. But happy only in the sense of good fortune, which we wouldn't use in terms of luck, but in terms of God's blessing. Our word happen comes from that root. H-A-P, hap. Something happened. That means that's the direction things went. It's one's fortune. You might read in the English, in an old English piece of literature, his hap was to come to this nice glen or something like that. His fortune was to come. So in the old English usage of happy, it meant touched by good fortune. Well, as Jesus would use it, he would not talk about fortune, but he would talk about being touched by a process that was God's process in one's life.
happy, happy,
happy, happy. Well, that's all goes in the same pattern. You see, if you read the Bible, if you read textbooks about it or manuals, you might get a different picture. But if you read the Bible, you find that most of God's servants, the apostles, were under constant fire and distress. Paul says, I know how to abound, I know how to suffer want. If I came into a meeting and said to you, I am suffering want. I suffer want all the time. I'm always suffering want. You would say to me, well, you're a very poor testimony. The Lord's supposed to bless your life abundantly. No, it doesn't say that. Paul says, I know how to abound, but I also know how to suffer want. If you read his statements in 2 Corinthians 4, for example, 11, 1 Corinthians 11, in some of these places, you'll find that his life was constantly in distress. He said, these hands have ministered to my needs, and I work night and day. Some would say, well, if he was really serving the Lord would provide his needs. Why should he have to work night and day when he's writing the Bible? He didn't look at things that way. He said, I can either live by the gospel or I can work with my hands. No big deal, one way or the other. He said, I'm going to do my job. I'm going to suffer some want. I'm going to have difficulty, privations, distresses, but I'm going to do my job. What happens to me personally doesn't matter. We have been bit by a syndrome that makes us feel that if we really, really trust the Lord, he'll give us all these things, you see, that everybody else has. That is not necessarily true. Jesus had nothing. Zero. And any man who goes into the work of the Lord with the idea that the Lord is going to now supply everything he had before when he was earning his own living is kidding himself. One really believes what they're preaching, they have to say that one may not even have a place to lay his head. And that doesn't mean the Lord is not with him. It may mean the Lord is more with him. If you trust him with poverty. But we do not live out that kind of a thing because in the church today, for the most part, we all pretty well demand a similar standard of living, generally speaking. We expect that. We think that if the Lord wants his people to have nice things, I've heard many people say that. There's nothing in the Bible about that. Paul said we are the offscouring of the earth. That's a very good point. The Bible doesn't say it's a sin to be in debt, but it says you should not owe anyone anything but to love him. That means you should not get into somebody's debt as far as a vow is concerned, as far as a commitment, your commitments to Christ. They have nothing to do with what we think of as owing a bill. Now, but the point you raise is really very, very important. The problem with this matter of debt, financial debt, is that a lot of people run up bills and then expect the Lord to come along behind and pay them. It doesn't honor God that we should be in debt, so let's give a little more. But who told him to build that barn in the first place? One man expressed it very neatly who was not really a Christian at that time. I think at least he was not very committed, but he saw the position very clearly. When a church he was in, people were talking about that. He said, well, it seems to me that people like a nice place to live, to have their meetings. They ought to just dig in their pocket and pay for it, but don't say that that's something God wants. You want to have soft seats? Buy them. But don't say this is our spiritual gift. Want an air conditioner? Buy it, but don't charge it to God. If you don't have enough money to pay for it, don't buy it. The question I'm putting out forward is, who ran the debt up in the first place? You did. See, there's nothing in the Bible that says a given radio program has to stay on the air. You know, and if you, maybe it's time that the Lord wants you to go out on the street, you know. Who knows? I don't know. I had a friend who really believed this sort of thing. He had a missionary enterprise to Russia. It's called Russia for Christ. And he went back and forth to Russia. He was doing great work. He carried Bibles and so forth. And then, for various reasons, the gifts no longer were coming in, and he faced the possibility of having to go into debt. And he just prayed and said, "Now, Lord, if you want these doors to stay open, you want this mission to continue, you see that we get the money for it." But the money didn't come in. So instead of blaming God or going into debt, he said, "Maybe the Lord wants us to stop for a while and do something else," which he did. Well, that's us. That's right. We're in a day when we are going to be very seriously hindered by owning too much property. Now, how long do you think the atheists of this country are going to stand for paying the bill of the church? Anytime they allow a church to go tax-free, it comes out of their own pocket. If I were an atheist, I'd scream about it. I'd say, "Look, how come my tax bill is bigger because that church over there goes tax-free and I don't even believe in it?" How long do you think that's going to go on? Like one columnist pointed out, they've succeeded in getting God out of the schools, but not pornography. They've succeeded in running God out of everything else. You don't think they're going to let the church go untaxed? Now, we pay taxes on our property. We don't file for exemption any longer. It's like moved in a different vein here, then. Because I don't want the government looking over my shoulder and telling me what to do. I don't like the tax forms they sent out for exemption, all the things you've got to agree to and expose about what you're doing and so forth. So we pay our taxes on the property. Now, we're not going to be caught short. We're not going to come up someday and find ourselves loaded with a tax bill we're not expecting. Now, these are all very practical considerations, but what I'm saying to you is there is more nonsense that goes on in the church in the name of Christ than you would realize. But people get stirred up. Now, I'm really not talking against a church or against a denomination or against denominations per se. I'm talking about the church at large, the church universal, of which I am a member. So I'm talking not against outsiders of any kind. I'm not saying we're the people. I'm just telling you what is a deep problem here. I'm not sure that it is God who has encouraged the building of these $1 million or $500,000 plants in the name of drawing people in. It is the Holy Spirit that draws the hearts of people together, not a fancy building. And my experience, which has been considerable, is that many of these big barns that get erected find that the spirit changes in their church when they get that thing built. And it becomes a far more formalistic or a far more organized kind of thing. And some of the warmth goes out. And the people don't come anymore anyway. If a person won't come to your meeting because it's not a nice building, you're not ready for the Lord yet anyway. So this whole matter of indebtedness, and it's all tied in with the original thought we've been giving to you here. Our focus is Jesus Christ. Now, when you have a ministry from the Lord, if the Lord wants you to reach out to people, what is your ministry? To present Jesus Christ. And to let Jesus Christ take care of impressing the hearts of the people by himself. He says, "If I be lifted up, I will draw all men unto me." But if we try to interest people in programs and grandeur and great projects and in religious programs and so forth, instead of in the confrontation with Jesus Christ, we may find them slipping off into a religious pose that leaves them without strength when they really need the presence of Christ in their life. Because they're going to be putting their weight on their religious program, on their religious knowledge, for example, or on their happy feelings, or on their fine program first, or on the fact that they are doing their work for the Lord. They feel satisfied because they're doing their work now. But you can be a worker for the Lord and not know Christ at all. Jesus made that clear. He said, here are people that come and say, Lord, have we not cast out demons in your name? And in your name done many wonderful works? He'll say, depart from me, I never knew you. There's only one thing that cuts it, and that is identity with Christ. And there is only one thing you can expect out of life on this earth that is valid and that is substantial, and that is identity with Christ. You cannot expect necessarily a roof over your head any more than Jesus did. It's nice if you have it. Normally the Lord is gracious to us and gives it. Although I've not always had one over my head, and I've not always had food to eat. But that does not mean that the Lord ever failed me. Paul went through the same thing. He did not always eat. He did not always have a roof over his head. He often was in want. But he went on with his work. He says, none of these things move me. Neither count I my life dear unto myself, that I may finish the work the Lord has given me to do, and the ministry which His Spirit has given me. So, I fear that there are a lot of things we are looking for in addition to Jesus Christ. And a lot of things we're expecting out of life that the Lord never told us we can expect. And that, He says, is where the trouble is. He says, having food and raiment, be content. But He says, whatsoever is more cometh of evil. Now, what does He really mean by that? Not that it's wrong to have more, but as I pointed out to you before, where are all our problems in terms of the material world? They're right here in this area of expecting more than food and raiment. You know, we're the ones that run up the bills. We're the ones that expect to have the same living standard as anybody else. We're the ones that expect that as soon as we get a few thousand miles on our car, the Lord's got to help us get a new one. We're the ones that expect all this. And the Lord says it's all right to accumulate it, but if you get some worries along with it, don't blame God. I've worked with people who have had lots of money, and it's a great burden to handle it. And you never have enough. People think, well, if I only had so much, I'd have the eyes. Man I know that could have retired at a very tender age and had plenty. He said, you know, you never have enough. Always concerned if here's something will hit you, it'll wipe you out. I'm only saying this. Whether you are seeking or finding your way in terms of your spiritual life, or whether you are trying to make sense out of your material life, there is one key. The focus on Jesus Christ will help you keep your perspective. Don't go to church seeking for power or miracles or knowledge or anything else, but to fellowship with and worship and share with Jesus Christ. Now that assumes, of course, you're sharing it with your brothers and sisters in the Lord. This fellowship with one another is a valid thing to go for, you see. But primarily, you're all gathered around the name of Jesus Christ. That's what you go to seek for. When you're looking at your material circumstances, realize that if you have everything in this world and you do not have Christ, you have nothing. But if you have nothing in this world and you have Christ, you have everything. Paul is praying that the Lord may grant you, according to the riches of His glory, to be strengthened with power through His Spirit in the inner man, in order that Christ may dwell through faith in your heart, that you, being rooted and founded in love, may be utterly able to apprehend with all saints the breadth and length and depth and height, and to know. Now here's the whole crux of it. He says, you want to be filled with power in order that you may know the love of Christ which surpasses knowledge, that you may be filled with the fullness of God. That's one thing to want to be filled with Christ, but the fullness of God or the fullness of Christ would be the same thing. It's another thing to want to have power so you can go out and do things, or power so you can be happy or something like that. That is a presumption on our part. Just come to Christ and live with Him every day. Now, Paul took that casual attitude. He said, I can either live by the gospel or I can live by my hands. He said, sometimes I live by my hands and sometimes people give things to me. But he wasn't worried about that. He was out doing his job. And I've often thought, one thing they can't take away is the work that has been done in the souls of people. Satan badges all the time. He can take away your health. The Lord let him take away Job's health. He let him take away his material possessions. He let him take away his family. He let him take away everything. And Satan can do that. And the Lord lets him sometimes. So he can take away your health. He can take away your home. He can take away your family. He can take away everything. One thing he can't take away is what you have in the spirit. And one thing with us he can't take away is whatever work has already been done. And you feel each time you get another, win another victory in the things of the Lord, just every day practically, every week, something happens that is a step forward in the ministry. I don't mean in my organization, because I don't have much of it, but I mean in the ministry. Some soul gets helped. Something happens that is an advance in the Lord's work. Almost every day of my life. And I think of it, I take another notch up the cliff. That's what it is, a cliff. I've often used the illustration of going up Piton over Piton. You know, you just drive a Piton in, you go up one step. And you drive another one, you go up another step. And it's sometimes very hard going, but I think every time I hit another step, I'm one step ahead. And that's something that Satan can't take away. So what matters if everything is falling down around your head? Another soul is born. Another life is helped. Another marriage is put back together again. Every day something happens in the spiritual kingdom. So I don't really care what happens in the other that much. It doesn't matter. I know that physically I'll keep going, but the Lord is still with me. But if I am gone, He'll send somebody else. So Jesus Himself says, don't fear the one who can take the life and after that has nothing more they can do. Fear Him who, having taken the life, can also cast the spirit of the soul into hell. So as the songwriter says, let goods and kindred go, this mortal life also, the body they may kill, but our Lord abideth still, and He must win the battle. The problem with the church today, or Christian people today, is for the most part, the spoiled rot. They expect so much for themselves, not only in material things, but religious things. Always, gimme, 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 gimme the power, gimme a miracle, gimme a happy feeling, gimme this or that. Just go along with the Lord. Wake up every morning and say, Lord, I'm glad you're with me. Go through the day. Take your lumps as they come. Take the good things that come to you and just go on. At the end of the day, you say, Lord, I'm still here. Thank you. And you wake up the next morning and you go through your life again the next day. And you know this, that no matter what happens to you, the Lord is there. And everything may come crashing around your head, but the Lord's there with you in the rubble. I had one supercilious lady say, well, it seems to me that if your life is in chaos, it certainly can't be a good testimony to Christ. And I said, well, maybe I thought, look at Paul. If you want a modern one, look at Corrie Ten Boom. You come and tell her that. And you might get a surprising answer. But you see, this is common that when we come to Christ, Satan throws everything at us at the kitchen sink, and sometimes that too. Never judge your spirit by the circumstances in the flesh. But unfortunately, we often listen to Satan on that thing. He said, aha, you see, if the Lord really cared, he wouldn't let me go through all of it. And this whole thing of the bills comes up. He says, aha, you see, he's not paying your bills for it. Good answer for that. They're my bills, they're not the Lord's. If I was foolish enough to run them up, then I've got to suffer for it. You buy a new car and you can't make the payments, well, they'll have to come take your car away. If they can take your car away, then I just sold. We get ourselves into these things, and there's no use even saying, well, you're not a very good Christian because you ran up a debt. No, you're just a human being. You wanted something, and you bought it, and you can't pay for it, so you're going to have to lose it, or you're going to have to put your nose on the grindstone a little bit more. But it is wise for Christian people not to run up debts. And it's wise. Well, we're not always wise. But don't blame the Lord for it. And this is so important to these Christian organizations who are constantly in debt and constantly crying for money. And one of the problems is they've got a bill to meet somewhere. And they blame the Lord if they don't meet the bill. And it's not going to depend on whether somebody calls up some money or not. It doesn't mean we wouldn't need it. It just means we're not going to use that as a reason not to come. Because I'm not going to talk about money. I want people to use the material. I want people to get the blessing. I don't care whether they've got money or not. The same with the counseling. I used to have an office over there, and we did it, but I realized that they just, you know, you can't put a price on counseling. People need counseling. They need help. If only the rich get the help, what's good? I mean, that's no way to go. If a person needs counseling, they need it. Many a person, we used to counsel week after week after week for a year or two or five, seeing them through some pretty rough times, but nothing ever said about money. Only one reason. I believe what I've been telling you here tonight. I believe it. I believe that Jesus Christ is the issue and the key to our whole life. And if he went through life, and Paul and Peter and the others, these other people, with that vision of the meaning of reality, where the material things were totally secondary, then there's no reason why we shouldn't be able to do that.